I'm sure that you'll hear the word providence identified and defined many times during this series, already have probably, but I want to touch on it again in beginning tonight. Our English word providence comes from a Latin word which means to foresee. Divine providence is the foresight of God by which He sees in His ability to know all things and see all things and determines to supply the needs that He sees His creation has. Now this providence is over all men. Matthew 5:45 tells us that God sends the sun and the rain on just and unjust alike. And yet there's a special way in which His providence is upon His children. Thus in Matthew 6:33, if we seek first His kingdom and His righteousness, then all things shall be added unto us, and like passages. The very same charge that's given to us in Galatians 6:10 is a mirror of how God behaves toward His creation. Do good unto all men, that's what God does in His providence, but especially unto those of the household of faith. And that's what God does in His providence also. Generally, our understanding of providence has to do with those natural means that the Lord uses behind the scenes, as we sometimes say, to provide for those needs He foresees in His people. With this definition, we can believe that this or that or the other was by the providence of God, but we cannot dogmatically say we know that it was. The best example I know of this in the Bible, likely will be used time after time this year, is where Mordecai says to Esther, "Who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" Esther 4 and verse 14. So, natural providence employed by God behind the scenes must always have that question, who knoweth whether? Who knoweth whether? We cannot dogmatically know about such things, though we can believe them. But considering the broader definition of providence that we have given before, that it is the foresight of God by which He determines and supplies our needs for the accomplishment of His will, we do well to include God's miraculous activity in providence also. And that, of course, must immediately be qualified, because God does not act by miraculous means today. And yet the Bible is literally filled with accounts where He combined the natural with the supernatural in working out His providence for the best for His people and for the proper things for those who were not His people. While we are left with uncertainty about natural providence, we know not whether, there is no room for doubt when God employs supernatural providence, because in the very nature and definition of that which is supernatural, it could not be natural. It had to come from God. God's supernatural providence is not employed today because He does not work miraculously among men. We have not time to study, and it's not within the purview of our study and subject tonight, to discuss the cessation of miraculous gifts. And I'm not even going to include in my lecture tonight the material that's in the book that just summarizes what the New Testament teaches about the cessation of those gifts. We'll simply pass over that and assume that those here will either read the material in the book and or that they are familiar with that's what the Bible teaches. That God does not work miracles among men today, and He has not since those last brethren upon whom the last apostle laid his hands at the close of the first century. While God does not exercise His providence supernaturally today, surely there is profit for us in studying some of those accounts in the Old Testament, and that is my subject, an Old Testament account, in which He combined many supernatural things with the natural things in His providential working. Elijah and Ahab form a tremendous study of this very combination of natural and supernatural providence. I will not take time, I will not have time to read the passages that we'll be discussing and describing and commenting upon tonight. But I'll tell you where they are in your Bible, and you can follow if you choose to. I hope that you will. Beginning in 1 Kings chapter 16 and running through the end of 1 Kings into the second chapter of 2 Kings, you'll find this lengthy record of the dealings of God with Elijah and Ahab, and of Elijah with Ahab. We first need to say a note or two, notice a thing or two about these two men, Elijah and Ahab, respectively. Elijah is called the Tishbite. He was from Gilead. He was a fiery prophet. He repeatedly confronted wicked Ahab and Jezebel because of their idolatry and because of their apostasy. And he became a fugitive from their wrath because of his opposition. God's miraculous providence was ever over Elijah. Then there is Ahab, the seventh king of Israel. He reigned in the 9th century before Christ, was upon the throne for some 22 years, and Scripture says of him, he did evil in the sight of the Lord above all before him. What an epitaph. He not only walked in the sins of Jeroboam, but he exceeded the sins of Jeroboam. He took a wife who was a Baalite, Jezebel, and he became a devotee of that God himself. It aroused the sore anger of God against him. His death came as a result of what appears to be an act of the natural providence of God. Now let us take up these things that God did in the life of Elijah first, and they will be interwoven with Ahab as well. And then we will turn to Ahab and take up his life and how God was working concerning things in his life. And again, Elijah will have to be interwoven with Ahab. But we'll do our best to study them one at a time. When we first begin reading of Elijah, he has confronted Ahab with the message of God, there will be no more rain. There will be no more moisture. Terrible drought will come. And that, of course, was a curse against Ahab because of his idolatry. Foreseeing the wrath that Ahab would have against Elijah, God told Elijah that he was to flee eastward, to hide by the brook Cherith, whose water would sustain him, and where he would be sustained by a raven. Well, we have both natural and supernatural providence in operation here. The message of God to Elijah was miraculous. It was direct. The water was natural, though, and the food was natural, though it was miraculous that ravens would bring the food to Elijah. The water dried up in the brook Cherith, and God sent Elijah to Zarephath in Zidon. There he had commanded a widow to feed the prophet during the drought. When Elijah came to Zarephath, identified the widow, he asked her what she was going to do. She said, I'm baking a cake for my son and me that we may die. She was on the verge of starvation because of the drought, apparently. Elijah said, bring a cake to me and let me eat. She did so, and God saw that her meal and oil were kept supplied throughout that lengthy drought. Her son died while Elijah was there, and she lost faith. And God, in his supernatural providence, allowed Elijah to raise that boy from the dead, causing her to exclaim that indeed this was the prophet of God. Again, the combination of natural and supernatural providence can be seen in those events. And then the next episode in the life of Elijah is one of the most dramatic scenes in all of the Bible, and maybe in all of history, where the difference between light and dark and truth and error and good and evil is in such stark and dramatic contrast that no one could deny it. It's the contest at Mount Carmel. The third year of God's promise of no moisture, no rain to Ahab, Elijah was sent by God to tell Ahab it was going to rain again soon. But before the announcement was given, Elijah strongly condemned Ahab for his Baal worship, and proposed to him that there be a contest between him and the false prophets of Baal and Asherah at Mount Carmel. Well, Ahab consented. A great host of people was gathered. The scene was very dramatic. Ahab said to the false prophets, "You go first." And so they sacrificed their animal, placed it upon the altar in the wood, and began to cry upon Baal. They cried and they cried. For hours they cried, and he did not answer, of course. They became so desperate that they cut themselves with knives. And Elijah ridiculed them, sarcastically said, "Cry a little louder. Maybe he's asleep. Maybe he's gone on a journey. You just don't have his attention." Brethren, there's a place to ridicule error. There's a place to be very sarcastic in pointing out error and exposing error. I remember well at the Hires-Blakely debate in Neosho, Missouri, April a year ago, that Gibbon Blakely got up and shamed some of us because we had snickered at some of his ridiculous statements. And then one of our brethren got up and said, "Gibbon Blakely was right. We had no right to snicker. We should be ashamed of ourselves." I don't think we should have been ashamed of ourselves. We should have snickered. I think Elijah was just snickering here. Cry a little louder. Maybe he's gone to sleep. Elijah then repaired the broken down altar of the Lord, placed the wood and the animal, the sacrifice, upon the altar, digged a trench around the altar, had water poured upon the sacrifice, and then had so much water poured upon it that the trench was filled. And then he said, "You people stand back and see the power of the Lord." And the fire of God came down and consumed not only the sacrifice, the wood, and the water, but the very stones of the altar. And the people were made to bow down and say, "Truly Jehovah is God." Then the prophets of Baal were taken to the brook Kishon, where Elijah slew them. And let's not be too judgmental on Elijah for slaying them. Apparently, that's just exactly what God wanted him to do. Again, the supernatural element is prominently interwoven with the natural in this grand event, although the startling, climactic fire was undeniably miraculous and supernatural. Note some of the ways now in which God's providence was at work here. First of all, the exposure of the phony God and the fake prophets of Ahab was a great gift to the people of Israel, to let them see again that Jehovah God is still there. Then there's the powerful, undeniable manifestation of Jehovah, which was most beneficial. They acknowledged God because of that manifestation. Then there was the confirmation of Elijah as God's man, as God's prophet, God's spokesman, at a most timely place in Israel's history. They needed to be brought up short and made to see that these were indeed false prophets. This is the spokesman of God. And then the slaying of the false prophets by Elijah was a sign of God's utter abhorrence of Baal and his devotees. Indeed, we believe that God ordered Elijah to slay those prophets. Well, the rain was to come. Elijah had already been sent by God to tell Ahab that the rain would soon come. And so he told Ahab that if he wanted to get home before the storm broke, he had better start, because it was about to rain. And on Mount Carmel, Elijah began to pray. He sent his servant to go out and scan the horizon over the Mediterranean. "Do you see any cloud?" No cloud could be seen. 6 times that happened. Elijah would pray again every time. The 7th time, the servant came back and said, "I see a cloud about like the hand of a man." Well, Elijah knew that it was about to rain. Surely enough, that cloud came over, became a dark storm cloud, and torrents of rain began to come down. The drought was broken. James in the New Testament takes this statement, chapter 5, 17 and 18, and tells us that Elijah was a man of like passions with us. He prayed that it would not rain, and it rained not for the space of 3.5 years. And he prayed again, and the rain came. Of course, it was miraculous in the sense that God caused the very time of the rain to be what it was. The rain was natural from a cloud. So again, there is the natural and the supernatural combined in this providential act. We have no promise, of course, of such an immediate and direct answer to prayer as Elijah received, but we do need to follow his example of persistence in prayer. Pray without ceasing. 1 Thessalonians 5:17. Well, the slaying of the prophets of Baal did not increase the popularity of Elijah to old Jezebel. She sent a message to Elijah that the fate that my prophet suffered is going to be your fate. And so Elijah was on the run again. This time he fled southward, even south of Beersheba. He was so disconsolate, so discouraged, he sat down under a juniper tree and begged the Lord to let him die. He went to sleep. An angel of the Lord awakened him, showed him that there was food that God had provided and drink. Then he went to sleep again. An angel of the Lord again awakened him and told him to take nourishment. You see, he was on his way to Horeb or Sinai, and he needed that nourishment. But here we see Elijah at a very despondent and discouraged place in his life. He was weary from traveling. He was famished from the trip for lack of nourishment. He was isolated from his home and his loved ones. And undoubtedly, he was tired of running from the evil king and queen. He had just gotten tired of the fight with evil. Brethren, haven't we all found ourselves there sometimes? We just get tired of having to fight evil all of the time. Why does there have to be so much evil? Why do even brethren have to be fought because the things they're teaching are evil? We get tired of fighting it, but we dare not give up. We dare not be overwhelmed by it. God would not let his prophet Elijah give up, and he will not let us give up. Well, Elijah's on the run further. He goes on down to Horeb or Sinai. He takes up residence in a cave. And there God asks him a question. Why are you here, Elijah? Now, God didn't need to ask that question for information, just like he didn't need to ask Adam, why are you hiding? But he wanted to hear Elijah's response. The question was for Elijah, not for God. Oh, I'm here because I have done that which is righteous. I have exposed the evil and the error among our people. And I have had to flee for my own life as a fugitive. God then produced a strong wind, followed by an earthquake, followed by fire, but did not reveal himself or speak from any of those things to Elijah. Then God asked Elijah the same question, and Elijah gave him the same answer. And then God spoke to him in a still, small voice and told him what he wanted him to do. Go to Syria and anoint Hazael to be the new king. Go to Israel and anoint Jehu to be the new king of Israel. And then anoint Elisha to succeed yourself. Among the things Elijah had said to God was that only I am left. And sometimes people talk about the Elijah complex, and that's what they're talking about. I'm the only one left. So far as Elijah knew, he was. I don't think he was being vain or boastful. I think he was fully convinced of that. But God said there are yet 7,000 in Israel that have not bowed the knee to Baal. Brethren, there's still a lot of good people out here in the Church of the Lord that haven't bowed the knee. A lot of them are right here tonight. But there are many more than this, I'm convinced. Dave Miller spoke at Pearl Street this past Tuesday night in a gospel meeting. And you need to get him to preach his sermon on baby boomers in the church sometime. But one of the things that Dave said in that sermon had to do with Elijah and his saying, I alone am left. God said, no, there's 7,000 left. Dave pointed out that 7,000 was only a drop in the bucket of the millions who populated the nation of Israel. And that is always the way it has been and will be, brethren. We are in the minority, and we will always be in the minority. There will always be a remnant of God's people that are faithful, and no more than a remnant. That's built into the system. That's in the very nature of the gospel of Christ. Those a few years ago who tried to get us all to think that we could take the world for Christ, and some are still saying that ridiculous thing, just are talking through their hats. They don't know what the gospel teaches. We are never told to take the world for Christ. We're told to take Christ to the world, but we're told the world will never come to Christ except for a few. Now, they all deserve to hear the gospel, but very, very few will ever obey it. And we might as well understand that. We are not by ourselves, though. 7,000 have not bowed the knee. Note at least two providential purposes in these demonstrations and conversations and instructions at Horeb. First of all, to restore the confidence and the courage of this weary, discouraged prophet. And second, to have Elijah anoint a king, Hazael, in Syria, that would bring punishment upon Israel, and a king, Jehu, in Israel, that would also be treasonous to Ahab and his dynasty and the kings there, and to anoint Elisha, who likewise would be a thorn in the flesh of every evildoer in Israel. So indeed, God's providence is seen there. The mighty sound effects and sight effects and the still small voice were all miraculous, of course. But through the anointing of these three men, God would bring His wrath upon apostate Israel and Ahab in behind-the-scenes providential ways. God's providence concerning Naboth's vineyard is interesting. Ahab coveted a vineyard that was next to his palace in Jezreel, and it belonged to a man by the name of Naboth. He went home and pouted like a baby when he could not get it. Naboth did not want to sell his inheritance. Jezebel said, "What's wrong with you, Ahab? Snap out of it." He said, "Oh, I just can't." Said, "There's that piece of property that Naboth owns, and he won't sell it to me." Jezebel said, "No problem. I'll take care of that for you." Now, the Methinis know that in Jamaica they say, "No problem, Mom." So Jezebel had Naboth stoned by some of her henchmen and said, "Ahab, go down and get your vineyard now. The matter is settled." Well, God told Elijah what was going on and sent Elijah to interrupt and intercept Ahab. When he came to him, he told Ahab exactly what he had done, though Ahab and Jezebel would undoubtedly have wanted it concealed. Told him that the very place where Naboth's blood had been spilled by those who stoned him to death, the dogs would lick Ahab's blood up. He also told Ahab that his wife was going to come to a very violent end, that she would be eaten alive by dogs. And then maybe the thing that hurt Ahab worse was that his dynasty was going to come to an end. God had had all that he could take. Naboth's vineyard was the straw that broke the camel's back with God and Ahab. And so these evil deeds of murder and larceny were brought to the fore and condemned. God miraculously told Elijah to go and intercept Ahab, and told Elijah what Ahab and Jezebel had done, and told Ahab what was going to happen to them prophetically. But the messenger by which that message was delivered to Ahab was just a man. It was a natural, providential message in that sense. We move from there to the account of Ahaziah, Ahab's son. After Ahab had been slain in battle, his son, Ahaziah, mounted the throne. Well, why did not God cut off any from Ahab's seed from the throne? That's what Elijah said would happen. Well, believe it or not, Ahab repented when he was confronted by Elijah at Naboth's vineyard. And so God relented and was merciful toward Ahab. And he said, "I will not bring to pass the end of your dynasty until your son is on the throne." And so Ahaziah was on the throne. He had fallen down in the palace and injured himself, and he wanted to know whether he was going to live or die. So he sent servants over to consult with Baal-zebub. God in a neighboring kingdom. Well, God said, go and intercept those servants. They are saying, in effect, that there is no God in Israel. They have to go to a strange nation and a strange God to learn things. And so Elijah intercepted them, sent them back, and said, you tell Ahaziah the answer to his question. Yes, he's going to die. Well, when the messengers reported that to Ahaziah, he sent 50 men under a captain out to arrest Elijah. Elijah called the fire of God down upon them and burned them all to a crisp. Well, Ahaziah said, I'll send 51 more men. And so he did, and Elijah called the fire of God down upon them, burned them up. A third time this was done, and the captain of the 50 this time begged for mercy from Elijah. And Elijah was told that it would be safe now for him to go before Ahaziah. And so he submitted to them and went in with them, confronted Ahaziah and said, yes, you will die. That is God's message for you. Well, in his providence, God rebuked and punished Ahaziah for his wickedness. This surely was demonstrated, the power of God was to the 102 soldiers, as well as their king, that he was still working in Israel, that he was still alive, and that Elijah was his man. But again, there are both natural and supernatural things being played out in God's providence here. The final chapter of Elijah's life is where he is translated into heaven. As throughout his righteous life, so when his earthly sojourn was over, God was still blessing providentially Elijah. Elijah is only one of two men who never died. Enoch, of course, was the other. Elijah and Elisha, as well as the schools of the prophets, apparently were all told when Elijah would be translated. And so Elijah and Elisha set out from Gilgal and came to Bethel. From there they went to Jericho and then on to the Jordan. Each place that they would come, the schools of the prophets would say, today is the day you'll leave us. Today is the day you'll be translated. They came to the Jordan. Elijah folded his mantle and struck the waters, and they parted just as they had when Israel first crossed over to inhabit the land. They went on eastward a ways from the Jordan, and that sweet chariot of fire swung low. Led by those fiery horses, Elijah was taken up into the chariot, and the whirlwind took all of it up into the heavens, away from Elisha. Elijah's mantle falling upon that prophet to succeed him. Thus God placed his stamp of approval and endorsement upon Elijah and his life of righteousness in a powerful way. He may be the most storied prophet of all time. In the life of Ahab, God's providence worked in many ways, almost always against Ahab, it seems on the surface. We're not going to have time to cover this material, obviously, but let us just summarize some of it. Even when God chastens his children, it is because he loves them and it is for their benefit, Hebrews 12 teaches. And when he chastens those who are not his children and punishes those who are not his children, even so it is for their benefit. It is to try to bring them to repentance. Time after time, it is specifically, explicitly stated when Elijah would bring the message of God to Ahab about a curse or some kind of punitive measure that was to be brought upon him and his kingdom, that it was to show him that God is God and that Elijah is his prophet. It was to try to bring him out of his idolatry. There is one particular thing I want to mention and then we'll close. And that's God's providence seen in the Syrian wars in which Ahab became involved. Ben-Hadad, the Syrian king, with a confederacy of 32 other kings, besieged Samaria, demanded Ahab's surrender. The prophet was sent to Ahab, not Elijah this time, to tell him that the enemy would be given into his hands. With a small force of only 7,000, the huge Syrian host was routed. The prophet came back again and said, they'll be back next year about this time. This time they'll fight in the plain because Ben-Hadad said, well, we fought in the hills and they had the gods of the hills on their side. We'll get down in the plain. We'll have the gods of the plain on our side. So the next year they came around, and the hosts of Ben-Hadad were there near Aphek. And the armies of Israel were nothing but two little flocks by comparison as they camped against them. But God again said through the prophet, "The victory is yours." And so the first day of battle, 100,000 of the Syrians were slain, and the rest of them were put in disarray and fled into Aphek, where 27,000 were killed under a wall that fell down on Ben-Hadad, and a few servants were hiding out in the city. The servants said, "You have but one possible choice. Throw yourselves on the mercy of Ahab." And Ben-Hadad did. And you know what Ahab did? He almost hugged that uncircumcised king. Called him brother. He called him brother. They sat down and negotiated a peace treaty, and Ben-Hadad went on his home laughing at old Ahab. God was sorely displeased with that, and ironically, it was from the army of that same Ben-Hadad that the soldier would later, at a venture, draw his bow and shoot the arrow that would go between the joints of the armor in Ahab and slay him. Listen, brethren, we have no right to call someone brother that is not a child of God. Ben-Hadad was not a brother to Ahab. He was no child of God. We have no right to go around brothering people that are not our brethren. We have a lot of brethren that are wanting to brother those who are not brethren now. And they're sitting down at the table and working out compromise peace treaties with them once every year at least on a national scale. My time's up. You've been a great audience. Thanks for listening.